Test, test, test. Test, test, test.
Good morning. This is 9 o'clock on November 26, 2019. This is the time set for the Records Management Committee meeting of the Arizona State Board of Dental Examiners. Going to be a bit challenging because my travel plans changed at the last minute, and trying to rearrange travel during the most traveled season of the year was more challenging than I thought it would be, so please bear with me, and I apologize. Can we have a roll call, please?
Mr. Goodman?
Here.
Ms. McLean? Absent. Ms. McClellan?
Here.
Dr. Morrow?
Here.
Dr. Schaefer.
Here.
Thank you. I want to thank all of the board members for serving on the committee, and I also want to thank our public members, Ms. Schaefer and Ms. McClellan, for serving on the committee as well. And I also want to thank our staff for putting together the statutes that are relevant to our discussion today. So thank you all. I think we will go to agenda item number 3, which is call to the public. Is there anyone in the public that would like to present their thoughts to the committee?
There's an
one person.
There's only one person, and she is not going to. Do you want to speak?
No.
No,
thank you.
So do we need to swear the member of the public in?
No.
No.
Okay, so if you could please come forward and present your thoughts to the committee at this point, we would like to hear from you.
So, Mr. Diner, it's Ryan again. The member of the public is an attorney, and she does not wish to speak.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. Yeah, thank you for the clarification.
You're welcome.
I think we should move to agenda item number 4, and that's the scope of work. I think the way to proceed on number 4 is to have the thoughts of the members of the committee regarding the scope of work, and then maybe once we have that squared away, we can then proceed to number 5, to the actual discussion. So is there any member of the committee that would like to give their thoughts on what the scope of this Records Management Committee should be?
This is Susan McClellan, and at a prior board meeting, I had identified an issue of the requirements for responding to a subpoena. I'll make that kind of the general issue of when the board issues a subpoena to a dentist who is no longer in possession of the dental records, how that response should be handled by the dentist, or what the expectation is pursuant to the statutes that we have of who's responsible.
Ms. McClellan, I sorry to interject, but I think that would be a discussion for number 5. What I wanted to do at number 4 was to see what product we as the committee should be providing the dental board, and the thought that I had in mind was to ideally prepare a report that the committee then presents to the board. So if that's the kind of scope and the parameters of what the committee is doing, and if everyone agrees or if everyone, you know, has other thoughts, I want to kind of clarify for the record what is the, you know, ultimate work product, if you will, that we are presenting to the dental board. So is there any discussion that any of the members would like to make regarding proceeding with the thought that we as the committee would be producing a report with suggestions to the board that then the board can accept or reject and decide to act upon? Is that the course of action that the committee members would like to proceed under, or is there any other thought that you have?
I think that sounds good, Mr. Diner. One thing that I'm concerned about is that we don't limit ourselves in scope as well, because, you know, there are certain things that come across the board. Recently, we talked about just a minute ago this, what Ms. McClellan was saying, but there's a lot of stuff with record keeping in terms of, you know, there's all these different statutes that we've dealt in, and there's a lot of stuff that's already there. And I don't know if we have to rehash it all as much as we got to figure out what we need to amend or adjust. I guess that's what I see. And I think it's important that we put together, you know, presentation or at least a scenario where we can go through our findings and leave it up to the board to decide what they think is important and necessary. So that's how I've always looked at it. I may be a little different than anybody else, but
I think I agree with that, because I mean that's ultimately what the scope of our discussion and report is going to be. Is, you know, we look at all of the issues that come up, we look at all of the statutes and rules existing, as well as, you know, if there's any gaps that need to be filled, that would all, you know, kind of be part of the committee recommendations to the board. So I was just trying to see if there was agreement between the committee members that that's the way to proceed, and then we can obviously, you know, discuss under agenda item number 5 the exact, you know, statutes, rules, and everything else, the substantive aspects. But I wanted to kind of clarify for purposes of number 4 that's how we are proceeding. All right, then. I don't think we need to vote on number 4. Ms. Edmondson, Ms. Williams, is that how we should proceed without a vote on number 4?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay, thank you. On number 5, Ms. McLennan, sorry I cut you off earlier, but this would be where I would ask the committee members to essentially, the way I see this is kind of a two-step process. The first step, I think, is for us is to list all of the issues that we as the Records Management Committee should take a look at. And in listing those issues, the one caveat that I have in mind is that we should refrain from discussing any specific cases that have come before the board, because this is not a place for discussing any specific cases. But I do want to encourage everyone to, if they have a case in mind, to only talk in generic terms without identifying any specifics. I see that really as the step one, is to come up with a list of issues that we can tackle. And then at step two, we can maybe prepare proposed solutions to those issues. So with that, if any of the members of the committee would like to give their thoughts on what issues we should be looking at, this would be the time.
This is Susan McClellan. I'll try this again. One concern or issue is the handling of subpoenas that are issued by the board to the licensees, and how the interpretation of the statutes are being used to try to enforce those subpoenas on licensees who are not in possession of records. I know another issue that was raised that I heard at a board meeting was, I think, how to handle the issue if the records were no longer in existence and it was still within the legislative time period for retaining those records, I think was another issue that had been raised previously at a board meeting.
You know, we also have to look at business entities that are not dentists and where our scope lies with them. Because as a board, my understanding is we have the ability to refrain and dentists and modify dentists, but business entities is a little different. Second thing we have to worry about is those businesses that have gone out of business. I know we've had issues recently with dealing with that and what their responsibility is and what the line of chain of patient records goes to. And then I think we need to reevaluate, just even maybe look at the statute on disposal of records when that is deemed long enough, and look at how, maybe reiterate how to dispose of them properly. So I think those issues need to be addressed too.
Thank you.
And really, I think legal advice would be helpful in dealing with business entities, because I don't know enough about that.
I think, I mean, in terms of legal advice, that would be a separate issue, I think, because as a committee, we have to first prepare a list of issues, and then we can think of solutions. And now, some of the solutions might need legal advice, in which case, you know, as a committee, we can kind of ask for separate legal advice, because Attorney General's office gives legal advice to the board, and I'm not sure if that kind of soliciting legal advice would be the right way to proceed. Ms. Williams, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and just to clarify, if you have a true committee of a board, you know, you can get legal advice, and don't want to single anybody out, but we have to be a little bit careful because you do have people from the outside on your committee. So it's going to depend on the question. Once we get a little more clarification on exactly what the legal issues this committee is facing and what you'd like some interpretation on, I think either Mr. Hargraves or I will be able to, you know, tailor our advice accordingly. Today might not be the best time for that, so that we can have some time to digest exactly what direction the committee wants to go in. So down the road...
I guess what I mean by legal advice is that I don't know whether we can, you know, enforce certain policies or make, you know, when it comes to the solutions of things, if that is in even our ability as a member, as a board, to be able to determine, can we do that kind of thing? Does that make sense? Where does our stewardship end, I guess, is what I'm saying.
with
right, and I think I mean that would be part of the discussion of coming up with solutions. Is I mean
right.
a committee we can essentially we have this brain trust of all of us that can come up with solutions, and then maybe at that point when we are at, we are in the process of providing recommendations is when the kind of legal advice that you're contemplating comes into the picture. So again, it kind of goes back to the fact that we have to have some sort of a report or a list of suggestions that we come up with before we can seek any kind of stewardship or any kind of legal advice from the Attorney General's office and input from the staff as well on if those solutions are workable or if they aren't. So I had, based on Ms. McLellan and Dr. Maher's suggestions, I think I have a list of 6 separate issues. Are there any other issues that committee members would like the Records Management Committee to think about?
Mr. Dinar, this is Mr. Goodman. I'm trying to understand, based on past experience with the board, how the responsibility of the healthcare professional has at times been interpreted as being the responsibility of the business entity. Tried to review the applicable laws, and I see the responsibilities that business entities have for written protocols, things of that nature for records. It seems that there's an industry standard of the business entity holds the records, therefore the responsibility is not the professional, the healthcare professionals. But I see nowhere in the law that that's true. The law seems rather clear that the healthcare professional is responsible with or without a business entity. So I know lots of words on my part, but that's a question I'm hopeful that this committee can answer and clarify for the board, is if there truly is the ability for a healthcare professional to not have the responsibility for the record, where is that in law or rule? And if there is no ability for them to delegate their responsibility and be outside of the penalties and responsibility of being the owner of the record, then how do we get the board to acknowledge that? So I'm just seeing this trap where, it's the business entity that has the record, but I don't see where in the law that's true. So that's a lot of words, but I think you understand where I'm going with that. Hopefully you do.
Yeah, certainly. I think that's one of the issues that we need to think about, and it has come up a few times. So yeah, definitely. That's number 7 on my list now.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything else that we should add to this list before we move on to kind of discussing each issue separately?
Mr. Dinar, for those in the room, it looks like we're good with that list.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for being my eyes. So kind of like moving on to step 2, and again, I mean, I'm not trying to restrict the list of issues to the list that we have. If at any point we think that there is an issue that comes up while we're discussing the things on the list, we can, of course, add to the list or maybe even subtract or however we want to proceed with that. So I want to take up the requirements for responding to subpoenas. I have my thoughts, but I'll refrain from kind of giving my thoughts on the issue until I've had a chance to get the thoughts of the members of the committee. So if with the requirements for responding to subpoenas, there has been some tension in the past as regards to the custodian of the records and the intersection of, you know, from a legal perspective, who is the custodian and who has the responsibility for answering the subpoena. So if there are any thoughts on that, I think Ms. McClellan had brought up this point, then let's discuss that point.
Yes, I had raised this issue before, and my concern is that a subpoena is being issued to a specific licensee, and the expectation currently is that that licensee has to go and track down and obtain the records if they are not in possession of those records, or do the legwork to get the custodian of the records, whoever that may be, to respond on their behalf to the subpoena. I think that presents some legal complications because, if number one, if a subpoena is issued to a specific licensee, that licensee has no authority, legal authority, to transfer that subpoena to a third party to mandate that they respond now to that subpoena and that they fill out this custodian of affidavit record of records for those submissions or response to the subpoena. A person cannot legally transfer a subpoena to a third party to require them to do that legally. Second, we have statutes on the books that say if a licensee has retired or sold their practice and transferred records to a new provider, that is acceptable, and that provider then becomes the custodian of record. So to me, the subpoena should then be issued to that new custodian. Number three, there we have a statute, and the prior statute was 12-2297, I believe. And it's also set forth in 32-3211 for the termination of a practice, or you sell a practice, that you can transfer those records. The other issue then is, in dentistry, we have a lot of associate dentists or employee dentists who do not maintain or do not retain records because they're an employee, and they move from practice to practice. And we also have a statute, or a couple of statutes, for healthcare providers, and then specifically for, I think, the dental healthcare providers, that say if you are an employee, that you are not responsible for retaining those records. So that means to me the subpoena should be sent to the prior employer, and then the prior employer is to respond to the records. And statute 12-2297 allows that, and I think 32-3211 also states that employees are not responsible for retaining records. And I think part of the problem has been is that the interpretation of the word maintain and the word retain in a specific statute have been mixed under the Dental Practice Act. So I guess I'll leave it at that to start the discussion.
Thank you, Ms. McClellan. I see your point. I mean, for example, in 2297, I think it's subsection C, where it says that the employee of a healthcare provider is not responsible for storing or retaining medical records. So, so I take your point that there is kind of this distinction between storing, retaining on the one hand, and maintaining on the other hand, and there is you know, some clarity that we can probably bring to that. But in terms of the kind of internal procedures, I see this more of an internal procedures issue, and feel free to agree or disagree with me, I'm just giving my thoughts, is when the board issues a subpoena, typically I think the practice has been that the subpoena gets issued to the licensee, and then at that point, I think the onus is on the licensee in terms of what the current practice is, to then inform the board that, you know, there's a custodian issue here, you know, maybe this entity or someone else is the actual custodian of the records. So in terms of the internal practices of the board, my question to the committee members is this something that could be resolved by kind of clarifying those internal practices? So if for example, the issue is that the subpoena is, once it's issued to the licensee, and the licensee cannot transfer the subpoena to someone else, should the licensee be informing the board about the issue, at which point the board can then issue a second subpoena so that the records to take the complaint and investigation further can be obtained?
And Mr. Dinar, I agree 100% with the process that you state, that if a licensee gets a subpoena and they are not in possession of the records, that they notify the board or board staff of where those records can be obtained, and then the board can issue a subpoena directly to that custodian. What is currently going on, and it's stated in the paperwork that comes with the subpoena currently to these licensees, that the board staff rejects when the licensee reports that they are not in possession of records. The board staff currently rejects that and says, well, then you have to go get them. Whoever has them, then you have to go get them. And that's even stated in the paperwork that comes with the subpoena. I personally, and on behalf of other stakeholders, licensees that I represent, I think that is where the problem lies, because it's fraught with many problems of transferring and trying to transfer subpoena, or making some third party respond on your behalf when the licensee has no control over that. So the way it used to be is that the licensee would report that they don't have records, but they would then also report pursuant to subpoena of where those records are located. And then the board would issue a subpoena to, you know, the proper custodian of the record. And that's the way I personally would like to see it handled.
Right, and so I think the issue there is, I mean, there are several things with what's happening. So on the one hand, the kind of response that so let's say, for example, the board gets a response saying, I just don't have the records, without kind of giving any reason for that. So for example, there are independent duties for maintaining records in the statute. So if the board staff is receiving kind of essentially like a conclusory assertion that, oh, I just don't have the records, then that makes it difficult, I think, for internal purposes to evaluate the exact reasons for that. that. So maybe one of the clarifications that we can provide is, I mean, there needs to be some kind of a check in the sense that is the reason for not having the records one of the reasons that is specifically excused by statute? So, I mean, I can see instances where there is a 6-year records retention requirement that has passed, or there is a sale of practice, or the person has, the licensee is deceased, or whatever the case may be. And in those circumstances, I mean, there would be an excuse for just not possessing the record. But without knowing what that excuse is, I think, I mean, I would be skeptical with, you know, having a kind of a practice where all that the licensee or the business entity needs to do is inform the board that they don't have the records, and then, you know, the board kind of has to hunt down where those records are located. So I think, I mean, in terms of the solution that we should think about is, you know, maybe somewhere in between. I mean, on the one hand, I mean, there's the notion that every licensee has the obligation to maintain all of these records. And if you don't maintain those records and don't procure them for the board, then you're in violation of statute. That's one side of the extreme. The other side of the extreme is just a mere statement that they don't have the records, and then the board has to go, you know, on a fishing expedition. So I think the solution would be somewhere in between, where if the licensee could approach this from perhaps like a cooperative angle, saying, okay, I don't have the records, here are the reasons why, I think, you know, I sold my practice or whatever the case may be, someone else has these records, and then at that point the board can then evaluate that and maybe issue other subpoenas instead of having the licensee go and do the legwork to get the records. So that those are my thoughts. If you have other thoughts, or if there's, you know, something that that might lead to unintended consequences in my proposal, I would really want to hear your thoughts on that.
I have a question. This is Dr. Schaefer. And it came up earlier. What jurisdiction does the board have over business entities? And when a person opens a dental practice, is there a statute that requires somewhere in that business charter that there be a way to follow records so that if an employee dentist signs on with non-dental employer, that it's made very clear to both parties and to the board what the responsibility is for custodianship of the records? Does that make any sense? I guess what I'm saying is, what can we tell non-dental business owners to do with records?
Yeah, I think that is an important important issue, and I actually we should add that as, you know, issue number 8, because there is some interesting language in the statutes that deals with, you know, business entities and the board's jurisdiction over business entities. So we should definitely think of that. But is there anything specific with regards to responding to subpoenas where you think this kind of, you know, separate set of statutes that deal with business entities come into the picture? So I guess, I mean, do you have, what are your thoughts or suggestions on how that should be approached?
Well, I come at this from different angles. I am a dentist and I own my own business. I also teach residents who often take first jobs with corporate entities, and they have concerns about these things. And I think what you said is kind of a middle-of-the-road approach. If it is true that a licensee does not have access to their records, to a patient's records, that they need to state exactly the address of where they treated this patient and be able to show with a branch office certificate that they did actually work there at this time. And then the onus should be on the business entity. Not that I want to relieve dentists of responsibility for doing less than standard work, but this is just the reality of corporate dentistry, that dentists are not always in physical possession of the records of every patient they've ever treated. So very often it results in added stress for the patient. And I think that that's a very bad outcome.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think what you're getting at, and please correct me if I'm wrong. I think, so if you look at 12, 2291, there is a definition for healthcare provider, which includes licensees, meaning licensed dentists, but it also includes healthcare institutions and healthcare services organizations. But I'm not sure that same definition carries forward into the Dental Practices Act. So that I think where the disconnect comes from is the custodian of medical records under 2291 are these four categories of persons or entities, but then under the Dental Practices Act, that's not necessarily the case. So that is a valid point, and I think there's something as a committee we should maybe think of solutions to how to bridge that gap in terms of we don't want there may be some things which we could do probably via rulemaking, but if there is a statutory gap, then my inclination would be that we could potentially come up with a proposal to take a look at the statutory language, and that's where I think Dr. Morrow's initial suggestion of maybe getting some sort of legal advice might be beneficial.
Mr. Diner, this is Mr. Goodman. I believe my personal concerns are actually with the law, because if we were to look at 32.32.11, when it comes to a subpoena, the employed dentist can very easily say, I recorded the record in a customary manner, no longer is it my responsibility, because C gives them that exact right. It gives them an exception. And then the retired dentist or the dentist that sold, as long as what they did was reasonable, and reasonable person standard, I guess, is where we'd have to go, what's customary. So in answer to the subpoena, it looks like they can just reference this law and say, I took reasonable efforts, and when I sold my practice, these are the efforts I took. Therefore, you can't ask me to do it anymore. And then the employee, it's super easy, just, hey, I'm employed, it's not my responsibility. I recorded it when I did the work. And so my contention would be is we need the law change, but that's not something that happens overnight. But the law very much allows the dentist to not be responsible, and professional code of conduct, all of that, they've got their exceptions quite easily here. It's concerning.
Mr. Goodman, I feel a lot the same way. I do come from the corporate world, and I kind of have some idea on how corporate entities deal with this. We're set up a little differently, that we do have a dentist owner, in terms of each state has an owner for their practices in which are in that state. So if there was an issue with any of our offices, That would go to our dentist president that is president, and we have accountability for it. We can sanction that dentist. We can do a whole lot of things to that dentist, but where we limit is if there is no dentist that owns or is in ownership of the practice, it's hard for us to censure a dental business or a non-dentist because I don't know if that falls in our scope of practice. That's my concern. So I don't think it's another viewpoint or not, but
I'm with you, Dr. Morrow. Your organization is too large for my bank account, but if I were to buy your organization, I'm not a dentist, so then it's quite limiting what could be done to me. And, you know, it's taking it to the extreme, which is part of where we're seeing cases go. I could buy it, take responsibility for all the records, close it, and through my negligence, not maintain the records, or so through some tragedy, and then there's a little responsibility that would happen. But that is where the law is today.
I'm with you on that. I'm concerned about the law, but that's a different topic altogether.
Yeah.
Well, and this is Susan McClellan, and I'm not sure I agree with your interpretation of that, and that's why a few years back the business entity law was enacted to give the board jurisdiction over non-dentist owners of practices. Because under the business entity statute, if there is not a dentist as an owner, then that non-dentist person has to register under the business entities. And once they register under business entities, the board has jurisdiction over them.
Yes, but
Well, when the business goes out of business, there are statutes of what has to happen with those records.
Yeah,
I mean, we can't ensure every possible scenario. But I think the laws that we have in place cover the retention of records. I mean, the example I think most people look at are hospitals. And, you know, hospitals employ hundreds of people and they retain the records. There have been hospitals in this community that have gone out of business or gone defunct in bankruptcy, and the records still have to be retained under the law. So employee dentists to me, or associate dentists, fall under a similar category. And then going back to the original issue of how you respond to a subpoena, I would expect whoever gets the subpoena to respond by giving notice of where they believe those records are kept. Or where they treated that patient and the address and the owner of that practice, so a new subpoena could be issued to them. I would never expect a dentist to get a subpoena just to respond by saying, "Oh, I don't have records." I think they need to explain where those records could be obtained or why they don't have those records.
I agree. That was my thought when I said the dentist should be held responsible for proving that he or she worked at a specific street address and provide documentation through a parent's office certificate that they did in fact work there. But beyond that, it's not excusing the dentist's bad practice, but physically there's just no way they can get the records. So if they're doing their best to cooperate, again, I see this from the point of view of the patient. And I am thinking of a specific case, but I won't bring it up. It's very burdensome for the patient when nobody can take responsibility for finding the records.
So I think this discussion is very helpful. So one of the solutions that I'm thinking of, and again, I'm just thinking aloud, so this is, you know, I want this to be more of a collaborative process. So one of the solutions could be that we could attempt to explain what reasonable, what the reasonableness standard really is. So it won't be reasonable if the dentist who is subpoenaed for records does not provide any explanation. But it would be reasonable if the dentist, you know, points to a specific place or a specific entity or a specific person that, you know, they believe has those records in their possession. So would that be one of the solutions we should be thinking about? Is that helpful? I mean, in kind of framing this issue, what do you all think?
Mr. Dinar, this is Mr. Goodman. My worry on reasonable is, you know, in a room of attorneys, my understanding is it's based on what would a reasonable person interpret it. So if we are to try to define a standard for the dental community, I think we would have to be specific on the expectations and have the bar be higher than it is right now. Because if the bar is, I sold my practice, it's the other person's responsibility, that answer is quick and easy for any dentist, and if that allows them to no longer be responsible, then we're back to where we are today. If the bar is, I sold it and I have these legal assurances, these penalties in my sales contract, if they lose my records, financial and otherwise, then that bar could help record retention into the future. I mean, we're in a world where any of us in medical care, we're keeping multiple copies of records, but the law and the sometimes interpretation of it through the board is allowing people to say, oh, well, it's not my job anymore, talk to who it is. And that person, when they lose their business, they have little stake in it because they no longer are licensed as a business entity. So I'm with you that if we want to set what we think reasonable is, we just need to, we'll have to be specific, and that seems to then get away from a reasonable person standard, because it's probably beyond our scope to be able to say what will be reasonable in the future. So it's a challenge. I'm back to just, we have to change the law, but that's not the easy solution.
Well, so, I mean, so the reasonableness standard that I was thinking of is not just like a layperson reasonableness standard, but what would be reasonable for a licensed professional to do under those circumstances. So that I view that as a higher bar of reasonableness than just, you know, a reasonable person. I mean, so as a layperson, for example, you know, my receipts are in a shoebox, but that would not be reasonable for a dental practice. That would not be reasonable for a business entity. So there would be or should be a distinction between, you know, reasonableness as a standard for licensees or those who are within the board's jurisdiction, and kind of everything else. So that was kind of my thinking process with the statute that we have at the moment. So I think think, I mean, we also need to, I think the reasonableness discussion really frames the issue quite well, because I think there are, like, all of these are, like, specific instances of, you know, what's reasonable, what's not. For example, if you are dealing with licensees not in possession of records, the reason for that lack of possession needs to be evaluated at some point. And, you know, if the records are no longer in existence, again, the reasons for the records not being in existence have to be evaluated. If you're dealing with business entities that are not dentists, again, we have to kind of look at all of those things. So what I have in mind for us as a committee is to, with the list that we have right now, I think it's a pretty solid list, is that we should come up with at least, you know, some solutions or some suggestions that we can provide in a report to the board, or some suggestions or solutions on which we could ask the Attorney General's office for some advice. That's where I kind of want to take the committee, unless, you know, someone has objections to that. So in terms of the discussion of the issues on our list, is there something that we have not discussed so far?
For the good of the order, maybe you could share what the list is again, because we have meandered some in our discussion, so we may have touched on all of it, but I don't know that we have it in front of us.
Yeah, that would be helpful, certainly. So on my list, I have the following. Number one, requests responding to subpoenas, or requirements responding to subpoenas. Second, licensees who are not in possession of records. Number three, records that are no longer in existence. Number four, business entities that aren't owned by dentists. Number five, businesses that go out of business, or dentists that go out of business. Number six, proper disposal of records. Number seven, the responsibility of the healthcare professional versus the responsibility of the business entity. Number eight, jurisdiction of the board over business entities.
Number three is one that the board likely could use a lot of help on, let's say all reasonable measures, professional and otherwise, are taken. If those records are gone, and they just are gone, what then? Because that is a real issue that will happen into the future. There's a penalty for not complying with the subpoena. There's those things, but how should the board proceed with an investigation if we can't actually ever get the records? Because right now, my understanding is at times it just keeps delaying the investigation, and that's not fair to the complainant or the party being investigated to have an infinite delay, or what seems to be.
Right, so I think, in terms of my thought on records that are claimed to not be in existence is, again, I think the six-year limitation is what the statute says, and if that's the reason why, I mean, if someone says, oh, the record's not in existence because this happened 10 years ago, that's an easy case, but the harder case is the records are no longer in existence because, you know, maybe the hard disk gets corrupted, or maybe the only copy somehow, you know, is not available. There's a corrupt file, or it's sitting on a server that can't be accessed, or, you know, any of those scenarios. I think those are the harder cases, and, you know, maybe the way to deal with those is that at some point there has to be some sort of an adverse inference. So we tried, you know, everything that's reasonable to, so for example, if someone, you know, goes through everything legally to sell their practice, you know, the server is with someone else, or, you know, the records are for good reason and genuinely with someone else. I think it's unfair to then put the burden or the onus or the adverse inference on that person. But, I mean, at the same time, the person who purchased or who is in possession of the records, I mean, maybe, you know, they have some responsibility as well of, you know, complying with the 6-year requirement or, you know, maintaining those records. So in terms of, I tend to think of the no longer in existence question as kind of like an adverse inference question, or as you know, a question of who actually owes the duty to maintain the records. Now, I may be completely wrong about this, but I mean that's my sense of that, and there are specific things I think in our statutes that deal with it. Again, I mean, there are definitely harder cases where we can't really deal with those situations, and at some point we just have to say, you know, yes, there aren't records here, so we can't really investigate. So we can't say if you know, the person really committed unprofessional conduct. But we can say at that point that the person who had the responsibility for maintaining those records, based on the statutes that we have, there was a dereliction of duty, there was, you know, maybe a violation of those specific records-keeping statutes. But in regards to the underlying investigation itself, again, I agree. I mean, without those records, there really is no way for the board to even investigate some of these things.
So, from a staff's perspective, and from a governor's executive order in probably 3 of the last 4 years, talking about the number one responsibility of the healthcare board is to protect the public, to say we're not going to do anything, and then to put the ownership of getting the records back on board staff, is a dereliction of what Governor Ducey's requested, which is to protect the public, and the duty then of the board, which is to protect the public. And so I like what Mr. Diner's saying about the negative inference or adverse inference. You almost have to then rely on the complainant that they're providing as much truth to their story, because, I mean, everybody that's in law, there's 3 stories, right? There's your story, this story, and then somewhere in the middle is the truth. But because we can't get to the truth because there's no record to prove one way or the other, then I think that, I mean, ultimately you complete the investigation without the record based on the complainant's position that they were harmed. I mean, I've been doing this for a very long time, probably not as long as some in the room. And we have gotten all the way to a revocation of somebody's license, not in this board, but another board. And lo and behold, right before you go to a hearing for revocation, the records appear and exonerates. And so it's really the responsibility of the licensee to prevent the discipline. We're still, as a board, I just included myself as a board member, the board is still charged to protect the public and should still move forward down the path to protect the public with or without the record, which means you may have to then take the complainant's word for it that they were harmed.
Mr. Edmondson has a good point that really we learned in dental school that if it's not written down, it is not done. And really, the record is not there to do anything other than to protect the dentist. It really is there as the documentation to show that you did good work. And if you have deficient record, that means you've got a bigger onus of responsibility to show you didn't do good work. Because if you didn't write it down, you can't prove that you didn't do it, or that you did it, whatever it may be. So that's the big key, is it's the dentist's responsibility, because the dentist needs to protect themselves. Now, if they don't have it, the dentist is going to have a harder time doing that, and it, like Mr. Edmondson said, it can get to the point where you lose your license almost, or have records disappear if you happen to have something that is negative against you. So I think that it does go back to the dentist to make sure that they're documenting well. I agree.
Yeah, so is it possible for the board to do a subpoena, give a deadline to the subpoena, and then no response, any response, record, no record, choose to proceed with the investigation at that point? If the standard at the board level, in the interest of protecting public safety, was we will always proceed after the deadline of the subpoena, then yeah, if a dentist can't produce it because they're employed and the business entity wouldn't, it got all destroyed in a worldwide, you know, backup error, whatever happened, now we proceed with the investigation. As a member of the public, my thought is that I remember my dental care far better than my dentist, but he or she has a better record because they write it down and I don't. And so that would be, to your point, Dr. Morrow, that'd be a real challenge for the dentist to say, oh, I remember that care I gave 2 years ago as one case that week, whereas I will remember it quite well. So it would, if we proceeded kind of in a no matter what, then that would, whether it's employed, retired, otherwise on the dentist, they could choose to put in the additional light work or not, and then we just go with testimony that we have. Is there anything wrong with that legally? I don't see any law that says we can't proceed with no records. There's nothing saying we have to have records, but our standard has been, oh, we're waiting for records, we're waiting.
Right. I think the standard there is, I mean, whoever is making a point has the burden of proving that, and if the dentist is not able to prove that, the fact finder, you know, takes the facts as they exist, and in certain situations, the facts that exist are predominantly based on what the patient has said, and sometimes the facts that exist are predominantly based on the record that the dentist has provided. That's the normal way that these factual evidence situations are resolved. Anyways, I mean the only standard I can think of is if someone else is reviewing what the board did or the Office of Administrative Hearings did, any decision has to be based on substantial evidence. So what is substantial if there isn't any document, or, you know, if there are independent ways to assure us as the board or as the fact finder, it could be an OAH proceeding, where, you know, if there are those parameters present, you know, someone is testifying under oath, you know, this is true to the best of my recollection, blah, blah, blah. So those are kind of the things that that are taken into consideration in saying there is substantial evidence, you know, even if the actual underlying records are not before the fact finder. Does that?
Well, Mr. Diner, in addition to that, we do have people who review the cases at our dentist, you know, and our consultants. That's a lot of our evidence comes with almost a snapshot. As a dentist, you can tell what's happening in someone's mouth by a snapshot in a lot of cases. You know, you missed the margin on this crown, or you did a root canal that failed, or an implant that's literally fallen out. You know, stuff like that. But we'll be able to get a lot of that information, and it comes back to the record of the dentist proving that the information that we have as a snapshot is deficient or wrong. And so most of the evidence can be found in that patient's mouth right at that point. So,
right. Yeah, I agree.
Well, the other aspect, too, is a dentist or any healthcare provider is allowed to talk about their custom and practice and what they do in situations. If they don't have a specific recollection, because a lot of these complaints are filed 3 or up to 4 years after the treatment was done, so you would not expect that dentist to have an exact recollection on that particular treatment, but they certainly know the steps that they've done for years and years and years when they are preparing a tooth for a crown or how they take impressions, things like that they can talk about. So I do understand the protecting the public and moving forward with an investigation if records are not in existence for whatever the reason is. But I don't think you can just say, well, if the records don't exist, then we take the patient's word as true and we ignore everything else. I think there has to be a mix of the dentist being able to discuss their custom and practice and their treatment under that situation. Because I know we have all seen and reviewed cases where the patient complaint is significantly different than what the actual treatment is, or the patient has a misunderstanding of what the treatment is, even though they believe it 100%, it's not factually true. So I think it all has to be weighed through everybody's testimony, not just saying if the records don't exist, then, you know, the patient wins here, whatever the patient's saying.
Yeah, no, and I concur with you that it definitely, usual and customary matters in giving medical care and or any type of care to patients. So that would matter, and the dentist in the investigation could still have that opportunity to answer the investigation, all of that. Just absent records, the dentist would share, this is my recollection of the events, and this is my usual and customary, and the investigator would have to do that. I think, though, that this would be a notable shift for the dental community if we were to proceed once the subpoena deadline passes with or without the records. Because right now it is this endless delay. So as a committee, if we're able to recommend that to the board, that I believe would be something that board could then, you know, take into consideration. That would potentially be a good product of this committee, is proceed after subpoena.
How many times has this come up that there's absolutely no records?
There's files right here.
Yeah, in my recollection, I've been involved in multiple discussions, and I've been on the board for a year and a half. And so it was, as a member of the public, I was rather alarmed that it started to look like a normal thing that's happened. And now we're talking millions of people, many millions of dental treatments and exams, but the fact that it comes up enough that we've formed a committee is alarming to me as an individual. Because it does. We get to the, I don't have the record, I sold my practice, they lost them. I don't have the record because it was destroyed. You know, and yeah, if we can find a way to continue the investigation, it would help in those cases. And it's taking, for the investigator and the staff, a very disproportionate amount of time, from my understanding.
Well, to me, then, it's kind of almost a two-step process of if the records don't exist, why is that? And then who's responsible for them not existing? And then continuing on with the investigation. Because the law allows a dentist to sell their practice and transfer those records to a new custodian. So when that time comes, then, if that new custodian hasn't properly maintained those records, to me that's a concern of why then the original dentist is being given an adverse inference for not having those records when that dentist took all the proper legal steps under the law to transfer the records. And why isn't the new custodian then somehow being held responsible for that?
This is Dr. Schaefer, and I agree with what you said. There are many different reasons why records may not be available. Sometimes it's the responsibility of the dentist who is receiving the subpoena, and that should be treated very differently than a situation where records have disappeared after the treating dentist has lost custody of them. And I understand that the board exists for the protection of the public, and I fully endorse that. However, assuming a dentist is guilty in the absence of records because a patient says so doesn't sound, I think we're all innocent in this country until proven guilty. And I think that in the absence of records, yes, it should be pursued. And I'm just thinking out loud, but it's going to make it very difficult to prove something, because what's going on in the mouth today is not what happened 3 or 4 years ago. I mean, as a dentist, I can say I'm not in custody of the patient's mouth. So if I cemented a crown 5 years ago that was excellent, but I no longer am in possession of the radiograph to prove it, and now the patient comes in with an open margin and secondary decay, I can't be held responsible for that. So I think we have to be very, very careful about upholding the law that you're innocent until proven guilty, and sometimes you just can't prove anything without the records, and that's just a reality. And there's no easy solution to this. So.
Yeah, Doctor, that's a great point. I like that you don't have hold their mouth in your records for that period of time. So I totally agree with that. And I really, when it comes to it, the general public and understanding of dentistry and understanding what's going on in their mouth, I don't give a ton of weight to that. It's when I see other evidence that comes in, and really our people who evaluate these things do a really good job. Taking a look, giving some additional evidence. So I think it does have to have additional evidence weighing, and not just the saying so of the patient only. So I don't think that's what we're saying. I think we're saying we need to either progress and move forward with the case, and if the doctor can't prove the records, I don't think that should let him off the hook either.
No, I'm not saying that, but I think that, like you said, there needs to be evidence one way or the other, and the evidence has to be weighed when examining the case.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
And we have a wonderful appeal process if a finding is found to be adverse in the dentist's eyes. But it would be, again, a wonderful change for the board if we can proceed rather than allow the answer of I don't have the records to win the day. So,
Mr. Goodman, do you think the solution lies in kind of maybe having some sort of internal deadlines for the board staff So, for example, I mean, if there's a non-response to a subpoena, you know, there's a waiting period after which we can just proceed, or if there is a response, you know, there's a waiting period, you know, kind of built into all of those things. So at some point, like, are you suggesting there should be some kind of a time limit or a waiting period, saying, okay, now that we have, you know, dealt with the records collection issue, at some point we have to stop that and proceed with what we have. So is that what you're leaning toward or thinking?
I'm suggesting that we allow the deadline to state an expectation and deadline in the subpoena, and then bring it back to the board with or without records after that deadline. Now, the board could at that point choose to proceed, to say, wait, you're right, we should ask this business entity instead at this point. The board can make the choice and leave it to the future board members to decide. But yeah, create the standard, because right now the standard is, oh, we don't have the records, so we won't proceed.
Right, and part of the standard, I think what it does is it incentivizes the licensees to cooperate with the board to some extent, because I mean they can't be just, you know, ignoring the subpoena, or they can't be just at the last minute saying, oh, someone else has the subpoena, and then the kind of reboots the time period for everything.
Yeah, and in this, what I'm suggesting is that the complaint is against a business entity at times, but not often, or it's against a professional. The investigation is of the actions of that professional. And so if they don't legally have to have the records, well, we'll still proceed if they can't obtain them. You know, they're an employed dentist, and somehow their employer wants to never employ dentists in Arizona again and won't give over the records. Well, then that's, you know, because what happens reputationally? Oh, our dentist was subpoenaed for records, but ABC Dental wouldn't turn over the records. Well, then, you know, it hurt the defense for the dentist, and he or she had to go to usual and customary and their recollection of an event years ago. It'll keep the process going for investigation. So,
well, I'm not in favor of that at all, that if a dentist responds by saying they're not the custodian, they don't have access to those records because I was an employee dentist and I'm no longer employed there, but here is ABC Dental and their address, and this is where you can get those records. I think that should be an acceptable response to a subpoena, so that the board staff can then issue a subpoena to the dental office, who is the custodian. I don't think it should stop there and the investigation proceed against the employee dentist without the records, because we know where the records are and the records can be obtained. When I was referring to moving on with an investigation, that's when the records don't exist. Whether the computer got hacked and the records got stolen, or whether there was a fire and the records were destroyed before, you know, the time period to retain records. To me, those are completely two different things and should be treated differently.
And so, I'm saying that yes, if the investigator gets a timely response and the investigator then chooses to act on that response to subpoena, or the board, through the board, subpoena the business entity, then that's part of the course of the investigation. But we have to have the ability for the investigation to end, instead of the endless loop that some of these cases. So, yeah, I'm with you that a timely response, but no response, oh, the statute, I'm an employee, therefore I'm free from the statute, I don't have to respond to my licensing board, that can't be acceptable.
Well, I agree with you 100% on that. And the subpoenas do have deadlines.
Yes.
So they, and I do think, and that's enforced, for not timely responding to a subpoena or not fully responding to a subpoena.
Yes.
I understand that, certainly.
So, yeah. But, so we're, the investigation is not of the dental records. That's a piece of information we're using in the investigation of the care given to the patient. And so that needs to stay centered to the discussion. So if I were the dentist subpoenaed and I said, well, I work for ABC again, hope they don't exist, and then the subpoena went to ABC and ABC said, yep, thanks for the subpoena, we aren't going to give them. They could be independently held accountable for not answering the subpoena according to their license. But the dentist still, the investigation of the care still needs to proceed. And if the answer is, dentist, we subpoenaed you, then you said that ABC has them, we subpoenaed ABC, they haven't responded, we're going to continue with our investigation, the dentist can present the evidence the dentist has. And that allows the dentist to have an appropriate defense. And if the records never happen, even if they're in full existence, ABC's got them, they just won't give them, we're investigating the care as best we can. We can't be in the spot to endlessly search for the records. What will happen in the world we live in is that dentists will go down to the offices of the former employer or the current employer and say, with attorneys in hand, say, you are going to adversely impact my life. And the records will, if they exist, they'll appear. I mean, if there were a bad actor on the business entity side. I mean, it's accountability is what we're getting at, and timeliness in the accountability.
I think the way to kind of look at this, I mean, we hopefully this clarifies some of these things, is at some point if the investigator, the board's investigator, let's say we have a timeline that the investigation, you know, let's say takes 180 days, 6 months. But if the investigation, if the board is still trying to collect records and there hasn't been, you know, so any obvious attempts at thwarting that records collection effort, then perhaps the investigator or the staff could come to the board and ask for an extension, just like we extend, you know, the continuing education periods, or, you know, so we, there's that inbuilt check where we aren't just having this, you know, without timeline, years-long investigation into something. I guess the concern is that at some point we need, as a board, to have some kind of timelines built into, because that's what's creating the incentives for the dentists, for the business entities to comply with the subpoenas, to cooperate with the dental board. And without those internal checks and, you know, the incentive and disincentive structure, I think it's extremely difficult for the board to, you know, even kind of fulfill its basic mission of protecting the public. So I understand Mr. McClellan's point. I mean, that we should not be, as a board, you know, asking the dentist to track down information. And if the business entity to whom the records were sold is not cooperating, then that should not come back to the dentist and bite the dentist, no pun intended. I think there are existing mechanisms in the statutes and rules that deal with all of that. But from the perspective of the Records Management Committee, we need to think of solutions of, you know, maybe there's something that we can do to internal procedures that doesn't need a statutory change, that doesn't need rulemaking, that can help us effectively solve this situation. Or, you know, maybe there are some solutions that where we have to go through rulemaking, or we have to, you know, propose or see if there is a statutory change that is necessary. So I guess in terms of the work of the Records Management Committee, today's discussion has been extremely helpful. I'm leaning towards maybe having a second committee meeting, just because, you know, not all of the things are going to get resolved in this specific meeting. But if that's the way that the committee members think is the way to proceed, is to, you know, maybe take all of this discussion that we have had, over Thanksgiving break, maybe think of possible solutions to this, and then have a second meeting where we come up with. So I believe at this point all of us have the list. We can obviously add to the list, but the list that we have and the discussion that we have had, I think the better way to proceed would be to sleep on it and come up with concrete solutions of dealing with this. And maybe, you know, as a committee, we can vote on the solutions that that we are exploring. And again, some of the solutions may not be solutions on which everyone agrees. But if as a committee we can propose certain solutions to the board, I think that would be extremely valuable, not just to the board, but also to the dental profession in general, because we do need to solve the records question on multiple levels.
Can I ask one final question? This is Dr. Schaefer again. Is it possible, and again, I'm new to this and I'm just thinking out loud, is it possible to create a statute in which it's made very clear that when a dentist leaves a particular practice in which he or she is either an independent contractor or employee, that there be some form of written documentation provided by the owner of the practice as to how records can be retrieved in the event that the dentist receives a subpoena? And the dentist is responsible for holding on to that document, and that way there's a chain of custody.
You know, in my years of looking at these things, I think the answer to whether there can be a statute is always yes.
is it possible that there ever will be?
I know, that was my way of leading into saying, you know, there are some things that as a board we can only propose, but we have no way of, you know, getting like a statutory change. So in terms of like the possible solutions we're looking at, if there is something that the board itself can do or accomplish, you know, maybe rulemaking is my kind of default go-to. My other kind of go-to is if there is any internal policies and procedures that we can take a look at, then that's something that's achievable in the short term. And anything beyond that, so let's say, I mean, if we genuinely need a statutory change, I mean, that's the one of the solutions that we offer as a committee. I'm not against that, but in terms of just the practicalities of the suggestions that we offer, offering a statutory fix would be, I mean, plan B, not plan A. And does that make sense?
Absolutely. And again, I'm just brainstorming here. I'm new to this. It seems like it would be a reasonable.
I think
we already have those.
In 3211.
Well, and in 12-2297, because it says an employee healthcare provider is not responsible for storing or retaining the medical records, but it's the employer who is. So
I like the last part of what you read also. It says something about but must compile and record or something. And so
they still have the duty to create the records according to the standard of care and according to the laws, but the person who retains those records is the employer, not the employee. So I think we have that. And, you know, this goes to a personal thing, but if you're a smart employer or employee, in your employment contract, all of this is laid out, but, you know. The board doesn't have control over that.
One of the biggest hurdles, I think, for this committee and the board is the entity, the business entities, because they can be owned by non-dentists. And we have that scenario right now. The board will be looking at three dentists coming before you because we've tried to get records. But essentially what's happened is the guy doesn't care. And I think that the law change to business entities probably should be like an ownership has to be 51% or greater by a licensee, which is really
good for the number. I'm rolling my eyes for those that can't see. I don't know that I agree with you. I think that we can enforce good standards without the professionals owning the entities, but yeah.
Well, they don't have to own at all, but 51% or greater. And it doesn't have to be one individual. It could be a combination of multiple people equaling 51% or greater.
But that's not the current law.
No.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's the law in many other professions. This is one that it is not.
So why can't the non-dentist business owner be treated under our laws just like a licensee and be given a civil penalty if they don't respond to a subpoena or they come in and they just don't care? I mean,
it can.
Don't we have that authority, that jurisdiction over that person?
Yeah. So, all of the action would be against the entity. And if it's correct me if I'm wrong. It's all against the entity, so the worst that we could do as an administrative board would be to revoke that business entity's license, but still be unable to have a record to complete an investigation or something. And then ultimately it ties up civil courts, possibly, because then you look at trying to do a civil penalty. They thumb the nose at the civil penalty to enforce it. You have to start heading through civil court. So it could end up to be nothing at all.
Especially if the business goes out of business. If the business fails, closes, then they no longer... And some of the concept is if it's a dentist, they have a future worry about action against their dental license. A business that fails and closes that's owned by a non-dentist isn't worried about future dental licenses usually. Or future business entity license.
Yeah, I guess you're going to have that, though, in any situation. Okay.
So here's kind of my kind of close-to-closing thoughts, I guess. I mean, we could, maybe have, like, two more hours of discussion, but I think the discussion that we have had, it has been extremely fruitful. My instinct is to take all of the discussion items that we have, think about them, and maybe convene a second time with the view that in the second meeting, we all come up with the solutions or the suggestions that we want to offer to the board. Do you all think that's the best way to proceed?
Yes, I think that sounds good.
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Williams, do we need a vote on that, or can we do on item number seven? Excuse me, item number five, or can we kind of just go to future meeting agenda items and maybe committee meeting dates, and then decide to reconvene?
Right. Yeah. I don't believe there's any vote required on five. It's not even on as an action item. It's just to review and discuss. So you're fine.
Okay. Good. I think that's what we'll do is we should adjourn and before we adjourn, obviously we should think of
the meeting dates. Again, I think that's something that we could do by email. I know trying to get everyone's schedules lined up can be a challenge. One of the thoughts I had is we could potentially meet on the same day that the dental board is meeting in December, and if that's not an option that's agreeable for everyone, then maybe we can meet on the same day or maybe a few days before the January meeting for the board.
So
that would be my thoughts, but again, if you have any specific scheduling thoughts on scheduling a second meeting, I would welcome that.
Mr. Diner,
I'm not going to be in the November or the December meeting.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, and for the staff, they have considerable work to do prior, during, and after the scheduled board meeting, so we probably should allow it to be a different day.
And I don't know if you've looked at the packet, it could be a long day. So and before would be difficult because we meet at 8, and after, I don't even know what the after
when
would
is
be.
After, so, yeah.
Yeah. We could do the 25th.
Yeah, most people have that day free.
Yeah.
Right, anybody working that day?
We can maybe decide like via email as I indicated initially, because December is probably going to be tough for everyone.
We discovered a new.
But I also don't want like a 3 month break. I want to have a meeting because again I think keeping like these issues fresh in your mind and thinking about solutions, I think there's some kind of inbuilt timeline again. I think helps us beyond the top of this. So I guess we could try to come up with a date in maybe the third or fourth week of January. But again, we can certainly do it by email to see who is available and times and dates and all those things.
So, Mr. Dinar, what we can do is Miriam can coordinate with you your schedule, and then you'll give her multiple dates that work for you and times, and then we'll create what's called a doodle poll. Some of you guys are probably familiar with it. So it limits the amount of emails back and forth, and you just basically fill out a survey of which one of these works best, and then it's super easy. So, and that will probably solve it for everybody if that works for you.
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
I knew you would have a solution.
All right. Perfect.
Now I can do a motion.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, well, I am ready to move for adjournment unless there is anything else that I missed.
So moved.
Do you need a second? I'll second.
Okay, so this is Dinar. I move for adjourning the Records Management Committee meeting. Is there a second?
Mara, second.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All right, thank you guys.
Thank you.